everyone, and welcome. My name is Andrew.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are Picture the Scene Podcast. We are a true crime podcast aimed to put you, the listener, at the scene of the crime. Now, each week we delve into the murky world of lesser-known crimes from the UK and Ireland, and also occasionally we venture into renowned cases from around the globe. We are available on all the social media channels. Just search for our name and I'm sure you're going to find us. And also there'll be links in our show notes. If you'd like to, and you have the capability, do also drop us a rating and review as well. Whatever you can, it means the world to us. So, as with any true crime podcast, listener discretion is always advised, and today there is no exception. Rachel, it's back to just the two of us again. How have you been?
It was nice having some guests last week, but very unusual there being like four or three other people to interrupt you. To share interruptions. But it was good all the same. I've been good, thanks. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been sparkling, thank you very much.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yes, we're recording this, everyone, at the end of the working week. After I finished work, and obviously Rachel's on maternity leave, so the weekend's ahead of us, and I'm getting a haircut tomorrow, so all good.
I actually made a comment, guys. Obviously, me and Andrew don't record these on Zoom for you guys to see, but we can see each other most of the time. And I said to Andrew, was he growing his beard? And he said no, all in favour of his haircut tomorrow. He's just been a bit lazy this week, so.
Yes, indeed. Going to a Turkish barber tomorrow. Recently discovered them for the first time, and they're excellent. So the question is, Rachel, last week we got some nonplussed answers, but are you ready for some true crime?
I am so ready for some true crime.
Great, let's go then. So everyone, if it's safe for you all to do so, I'd like you to relax, close your eyes and picture the scene. Today I'd like to take us back to the 22nd of June, 2023. So last year, if you hadn't noticed, we're heading off to Weston, which is a small village on the edge of Leicester. It's got a population of around 7,000 people. It's consisting mainly of people who work in Leicester but want a quieter life than a city life, a little bit more rural. And it is small, so the biggest thing to note is that the over 60s National Tap Dancing Doubles Competition is held there every year.
Is a fun fact about Leicester. Or the Weston. Town in... Yeah. Weston in Leicester. And just, guys, I don't know whether you picked up on me chuckling through Andrew's fun fact about Weston there, but Marnie is making such a loud noise, and I'm really sorry. It's almost like she's thought, hey, we're recording, I'm going to be make myself known on this pod episode. So maybe, I'm sorry in advance.
Maybe she's just really into tap dancing.
Maybe, yep, you've obviously piqued her interest with tap dancing. Yes.
So on this day, it was a Thursday, and we're in the early evening, and the weather that day in the area was nice. Yeah, there was sun, no real wind, no rain, and there was a temperature hovering around 74 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 23 degrees Celsius. It was a nice, warm summer's day and evening in England. So we're heading off to Loughlin Close in Weston and to the flat of Natasha Morales. Now, Natasha, or Tasha, as she likes to be called, so we're going to stick with that, was 40 years old at the time, and she lived in a flat on Loughlin Close. So she seemed to be a kind soul who hadn't had an easy life so far. She'd had many issues and problems in her life, but it was testament to the person that she was that she was still loved by all, and her name was synonymous with kindness, caring for people, loving, and being fiercely loyal and protective of those in her life.
Oh, she sounds lovely.
Yes, we all need people like that in our lives, don't we?
Absolutely.
Now, her smile...
Yeah, that she's going to be the centre of our episode, and you're going to say that some not-so-lovely things happened to her.
We'll see. Hopefully not, but we'll see. I do know, but obviously, we'll see. Her smile, it lit up the room, Rachel, and she had a laugh that instinctively just made you start laughing out of control yourself.
Oh.
And she was a key member of her family, especially to her mother, Jacqueline, brothers and sisters, Joel, Ison, Joshua and Simone. One of Tasha's issues that she had in life is that she had become addicted to cocaine, and in an attempt to fight the disease of addiction, she had admitted herself into what is known as a dry house in Weston-super-Mare. Now, a dry house is what is known as third stage accommodation in the recovery process, and they're usually used by people who have been in a rehab facility as somewhere to live for them after they leave the rehab so they can concentrate on their recovery still.
Okay.
So they can be extremely useful if being in your normal network of friends mean that you're more likely to be exposed to whatever substance you're trying to recover from, and therefore more likely to relapse. And once the person feels more secure, then they can move back into their standard living pattern. So they say that a recovering addict should always be careful of people, places and things. This is one way for sure of them combating those three things while being away from what is usually an isolated, so therefore a super safe, rehab facility.
Yeah, because the problem, if you want to call it that, although I don't like calling it that because these things do a lot more better good than they do bad, but the problem with it is you're kind of protected, aren't you, and isolated, and it's kind of helping you overcome your addiction. But long term, like, how sustainable is it when you're around, gosh, my memory is not what it used to be, you know, around influential people and you know, the bad things again in real life, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a great, like, halfway, because they can live but not be just super protected. So yeah. So yeah. At this time, Tasha had a boyfriend, Reuben Craven. Now, the pair seemed to have lots of issues in life, but on the surface, at least, I couldn't find much information about the relationship. But they seemed to be in love. And it wasn't an abusive relationship or anything like that. Though, again, I say with caution because I couldn't find huge amounts out on that aspect. So Reuben had been in and out of prison. Now, while in prison, on one occasion, he had met a man called Shannon Grant. Now, they quickly became close friends in prison. So when Shannon got out of prison, while Tasha was in the dry house in Weston, he met and became friends with her also, given that he was best friends with her partner. Tasha and Reuben stopped seeing each other for a while. Again, apologies, I can't find the time they stopped, but in May of 2023, Tasha had moved into her own flat and was doing well in her recovery, and moving into her own place was a big step for her. So at the start of June of 2023, Tasha was back with Reuben, with both of them considering themselves to be in a relationship with the other, but then something happened that would be a big setback for Tasha, Rachel.
Oh no.
On the 5th of June, 17 days before we will eventually get to Tasha and the day in question, Tasha and Reuben were driving in her car, with Reuben doing the driving when they were involved in a car accident. So Tasha would only have minor injuries and she would be able to walk away from the crash unharmed. But Reuben, who was driving, he was seriously injured. And he would die 4 days later on the 9th of June.
Oh, wow.
So Tasha, as you can imagine, Rachel, especially because you're so sensitive when you come out of rehab, in recovery, in the early stages of recovery, she was devastated. She was stricken with grief. She was overcome with emotion. But she saw hope, though. Two of Reuben's close friends, Shannon, who I mentioned a moment ago, and a person called Irish, started looking after her. So much so that Tasha would describe the pair to her mom as her guardian angels.
Ah.
So sadly, though, while there seemed to be no issues with Irish, Shannon had ulterior motives for befriending Tasha. So you see, Rachel, because Reuben and Shannon had been best friends, Reuben at some point had told Shannon that Tasha had inherited £50,000 from her grandmother, who had passed away the year before.
What?
Yeah, so in order to help Tasha, her mum had kept the money, and she would send Tasha bits of it whenever she would request it, so it wasn't too much of a temptation, and so it didn't get spent all in one. And that's a very reasonable thing to do, given Tasha's past, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And very trusting of Tasha to let her mum be controlling the money as well, because I can imagine if you've come from a life of addiction, trusting people would be quite hard as well.
It would be, yeah, although her mum and Tasha, they were as close as like a mother and daughter could be.
Okay.
And it stayed throughout. But and this was, so her mum being in control of the money, this was something that Shannon also knew about. Because Shannon, he was not a very nice man, Rachel. He was from and he lived in Coventry. And he was a self-confessed drug dealer who would travel about selling drugs with his driver, Stephen Hazel. And now he was 26 at the time, and he had a long-term partner of... I've just realised, sorry. He had a long-term partner of 13 years, so he'd been with this person since he was 13. Wow. He had a long-term partner of 13 years with whom he lived with, and he had two young children. So he was not shy about using violence, though, or threats of violence in his line of work. And he would often carry about with him a loaded sawn-off shotgun. So in order to get what he wanted out of Tasha, which was her money, despite having a long-term partner and children, he took advantage of the grief Tasha was feeling by manipulating her and turning their relationship into a sexual relationship. Now, in almost no time, she was buying him gifts such as a watch and clothes, among other things. And he even had her bank card attached to his Google Pay so that he could just use it to tap and pay for items in shops when he wanted to.
So she must have, that relationship must have switched very quickly from platonic to sexual. Yeah,
because they had the crash on the 5th of June. Her boyfriend died on the 9th. And we're talking, when we get to it eventually, about the 22nd of June. So from the crash to the talking of 17 days or 13 days from her boyfriend's death. So yeah, extremely quickly. So Shannon also had 5 convictions for 10 offences from an early age, which were for violence and robbery. Often the two combined, with his last conviction being for robbery, where he received a sentence of 7 years and 3 months in total. So you know it must have been a serious, like, violent robbery for that amount of time.
Yep. He is not a nice man.
No. So let's get back to the day I originally mentioned, shall we? The 22nd of June. To show you how close Tasha was with her mom, she actually had saved in her phone, her mom's phone number as my life. So it shows you how close they were, the two together. So at 5:47 p.m, it was that phone, Tasha's phone, that sent 3 messages to her mom, Jacqueline. And the 3 messages said, "Can you send me 2,000, please? I've been fined. I need to pay it now. I'll send you the address of the police station, Omar." And then the second one just said, "At." And the third one said, "ASAP, mom, please. Can't talk. They let me send texts instead of my call." Now, obviously, we are true crime enthusiasts, so we know that the police wouldn't let you text message instead of taking your phone call, would they?
I'd know, because they record those calls and they're done right in front of the charging sergeant, aren't they? So that you can't be saying things, let alone, God, texting somebody from your cell. Oh, yeah, no.
Exactly. So 1 minute later, at 5:48, her phone then sent a text message to one of her friends called Sebastian Craven that simply said, "Call." So Sebastian replied, saying to give him 10 minutes as he was eating, and then he received a response 6 minutes later saying, "Okay, need to be quick or they're going to book me." So book, it's slang term for arrest.
Yeah.
Tasha,
not like book him in like he's already been arrested, right?
Yeah. Oh, this is from Tasha's phone, but yeah, so.
Oh, me, yeah.
So Tasha's mother was worried about her. So at 8:35 p.m., she turned up at Tasha's flat with Tasha's brother, Joel, to check up on her. Now, Tasha's flat was on the second floor, so they couldn't look through the windows. But instead of anyone answering the door when they tried to, like, ring the bell, Shannon looked out of the window instead. And so they didn't actually know what Shannon looked like, so they didn't know who it was. Just a random man. But he opened a window, and he told them that Tasha had been fined and she'd gone to the police station in Weston-super-Mare to pay the fine. So when the pair asked of their master to come in, as you would, to the flat, Shannon refused, saying that they wouldn't want to see the flat as it was in too much of a mess and they'd get upset. So Shannon and...
Did he offer any explanation as to why he was in the flat without her?
No. He didn't even say who he was, but no, he didn't know.
Okay.
So Shannon then left the window, and the pair of them could hear what they would later describe as a sound of panic, doors banging and slamming, footsteps and other noises. And the person, well, there's a couple who lived in the flat below, but one of them, the lady in the couple, said that at the same time, she heard something heavy hit the floor in the kitchen area of Tasha's flat that was then followed by a dragging sound. So unbeknown to Tasha's mum and brother, Shannon had made his way out of a window at the back of the building, carrying lots of things in his arms. He made his way down an alleyway and onto nearby College Road, where he put in a bin his top, a rucksack and a black bag. So let's rewind a little bit, shall we, Rachel, to see what went on and why he didn't want him in the flat and how Tasha was involved in all of this. So the day before, on the 21st, Shannon started his day like any other, not doing much, before picking one of his kids, his daughter, up from school in the afternoon. When he had got home, he contacted his driver, Stephen. He then collected his shotgun, his tomahawk axe, and a crowbar, and he got into the car when his driver turned up. So obviously he collected his weapons. So firstly, they went to a local shop near his home, and they bought some cable ties, with Tasha's card, might I add, because he had it on his Google Pay. And then they made their way to Leicester, picking Tasha up from a pub, before the three of them went to Coventry, before going back to Tasha's flat in Leicester. And at around 9 p.m. that evening, they arrived at Tasha's flat. So he speculated that evening that the three of them drank and possibly got high, and the neighbour downstairs said that for a few minutes she could hear banging, and she assumed Tasha was just doing some DIY with a hammer. And at 11:23 p.m. that evening, Shannon sent a text message to his partner saying, "All night, be back in the a.m. Her mummy's asleep, can't transfer to 8. Got her tied up, delete message, no contact till morning, location on, love you."
Sorry. So Shannon's missus knew.
Well, you'd assume that she did, but his partner didn't actually see the message until the next morning and assumed he was high and hallucinating because she simply replied, "I don't know what you're talking about." And she didn't delete the message and she didn't do anything. She just replied, "I don't know what you're talking about."
Wow.
So now we don't know if he did have Tasha tied up or not, but we do know that at 1:38 a.m, Tasha had collected a takeaway delivery order from outside her home for 2 hours later. So the delivery driver saw her and said there was nothing odd about her. She looked just normal as anybody else would. So at 9:25 a.m. the next morning, Shannon's driver, Stephen Hazel, he left the flat. And that morning, Tasha phoned her mum, as she did every morning. But the call didn't last long because her mum was on her way out to Mark Windrush Day. Now, her mum did say that Tasha sounded tired, but Tasha told her that she was at home at her flat. So her mum didn't think anything of it. So Tasha's downstairs neighbour returned home from work at 2 p.m. and he said he could hear music coming from upstairs, something which he said was not unusual. So he didn't pay much attention to it. He just put the TV on and started watching TV. Now, he then said that between 3 and 4 p.m., he heard Tasha scream, followed by a couple of thuds. The neighbour said that he had assumed Tasha just tripped over something, and he again didn't give it any consideration. So between 3:45 and 4:15 p.m., Tasha made 3 phone calls to one of the banks she had money in, and then 90 minutes later, text messages were sent to her mum and the ones which I mentioned before, saying that she'd been fined and she needed money. What is now commonly accepted and believed However, it is that by the time those messages were sent to her mom, Tasha was already dead. What we do know, though, is that shortly after those text messages were sent, about 30 minutes later, Shannon started to make several calls to his partner, his driver, and to all of his friends in an attempt to try and find someone who could come and pick him up from Leicester from Tasha's flat. He couldn't find a lift, though, which is why he was still there when Tasha's mum and brother turned up 2 hours later.
What, like, can I ask why he wouldn't just leave and catch a bus or a train or...
Well, I don't know. Maybe he didn't want to be seen on CCTV and he had his guns, a gun and weapons.
Of course, all of his weapons, right? Yeah.
Okay. When her mum and brother couldn't gain access to the flat and Shannon had stopped responding, they then called the police because they were concerned for Tasha. And when the police gained access to the flat, they eventually found Tasha's body in the storage drawer under her bed, naked, lying on her front with a blanket covering her stomach. There was blood coming from her left ear, her left temple, her mouth, and her nose. She had significant bruising to her left eye, and there was an iron with blood on it next to her head. So an iron, what you iron your clothes with.
Yeah.
When they went to see if she was still alive, they found a gag in her mouth and a cable tie so tight that they originally didn't see it around her neck.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. Later examination would determine that Tasha had been tortured with 25 separate injuries to her head, arms and legs. Now it's worth noting that police managed to find CCTV of Tasha from the day before and she had no injuries on her. So these must have happened during the night or on that day.
That's some pretty good police detective work, isn't it? Because they could have quite easily chalked it down to like a druggy, you know, whatever they wanted, painted a picture and not done any proper investigation work. But the fact that they've trawled through CCTV footage to find her 24 hours earlier or at any point earlier is quite thorough.
Exactly. And Tasha also had burns to her right arm and marks indicating that she'd been bound by her ankles and wrists with cable ties. You remember Shannon went and bought cable ties with her card.
Yeah, which just adds insult to injury, the fact that she had to buy her own, really.
Yeah. It wouldn't take long for the police to catch up with Shannon. And the day after, actually the very early hours of the morning, on the 23rd of June, they arrested him on the suspicion of murder of Tasha. So he would no comment in his interview and he would go to trial for Tasha's death. His defence was that Tasha, himself and Stephen, his driver, they were planning on setting up a drug dealing business from her flat as some rival drug dealers had turned up and killed Tasha trying to find out where they had hid their drugs, but he had managed to escape.
Wait, can I just say, and I understand that everyone has the right to be defended in this country, but he's getting his defense for free, right? On the state legally.
Yeah, because it's a Crown Court, so yeah.
How on earth he has got the balls, the audacity to go and concoct such a story for his defense? And oh God, we were setting up a drug dealing business and a rival drug gang came along, and then what, throwing his driver in the mix as well, who was by all accounts completely innocent in this whole ordeal.
A
whopper. And like, yeah, what he's done is so calculated, and the idiot probably at this point didn't realize his text message to his missus was going to be part of the prosecution's evidence. What a dickhead. Sorry.
Or the fact that he spoke to her mom and brother.
Or that fact too. Yeah, what a whopper. And the fact that a defence aren't going to say, come on, fella, we're not saying that in a court of law.
Well, they have to do as instructed, don't they? But yeah, I get what you're saying. So the prosecution argued the fact that he had bought cable ties, taken weapons and clothes to her flat. And by the way, the bags that he put in the bin after he left her flat, he actually collected them when he finally got a lift home, and the police found them the next day when they arrested him. His top had her blood on it, as did the crowbar. So when that was put to him in court, he said that her blood got on the top, on his top, when she was being tortured by the rival gang, and it had gotten onto the crowbar when she'd been in the accident that killed Ruben. So he said that, oh, she must have taken it out of the car and got her blood in it then.
And just out of interest, what was his defence as to why he wasn't tortured?
Well, he managed to escape just before they tortured him.
But why was her blood on him if he managed to escape?
Because they just tortured her first, so...
Oh, so he had to watch the torturing and then manage to escape?
Yes.
Yeah, what a dick.
So he admitted in court that he was a drug dealer. And he said that was the explanation as to why he carried a weapon around with him. He said that he couldn't remember why he had sent that text message to his girlfriend. But he did admit that he knew Tasha had money and that her mum controlled it. It was put to him that the scream and bangs the neighbour heard was from Tasha when he started to torture her that afternoon before he gagged her. It was also shown through evidence from the flat that the bang from the kitchen the neighbour heard, you know, when her mum and her brother turned up.
Yeah.
And the doors and bangs that her mum and brother heard, they were most likely him cutting her free from a chair that he'd cable tied her to, and he tortured her on in the kitchen, and then dragging her body to the bedroom before hiding it under their bed.
What a sick individual. Yes.
He couldn't explain why he told her mum that she was at the police station when she was already dead.
And why
that matched the text that her mum had received asking for money when it didn't happen. He couldn't explain why the message he'd sent his partner the night before matched what would eventually happen to Tasha if a rival gang had done it the day after. He was unsurprisingly found guilty of her murder. The prosecution, I mean, imagine like the jury just going in and going like, do we need to discuss this? The prosecution argued for a whole life order, but the judge said that it fell just below the threshold. She, the judge, stated that there were several aggravating factors, with the main ones being the suffering Tasha would have endured and the fact that the murder was for gain. And also the fact that not only did he have a gun with him, he had a sawn-off shotgun, which is, under the eyes of the law, even worse. It carries more years. So if you've got a gun, it can carry, like, usually in that situation, a minimum of 4 years. Obviously, if there's no murder. If you've got a sawn-off shotgun, it carries a minimum of 7 years. So it shows you the difference there. So we know it's not a whole life order. So I want you to guess how long it is, because I like you doing this, Rachel. But before I do, to give you a bit of a clue on our listeners, in case they guess along, a standard murder has a starting point of 15 years before any factors are taken into account. A murder for gain, as what the judge said this is, has a starting point of 30 years.
Oh, wow.
So what do you think Shannon got?
Well, I'm glad you gave us that background, because I'd have gone in lower after my really high guess last week and you were like, don't be ridiculous. I'm just going to say before I do guess, do you ever think, you know, you made the point that it didn't quite cut the mustard for a whole life order.
Yeah.
Do you ever think they're really strict on whole life orders because they want to keep the numbers low? It's like a really elite criminal club and they don't want to like hand them out willy-nilly, because actually when they do give them out, they want those criminals to feel like you have really, really fucked up, like you are going down forever. Whereas if they just gave them to like single killers or killers of like one-off killers, like one-time killers, that they'd be handed out left, right and center, wouldn't they?
I don't think that, because I kind of know the reason why they don't give out as many whole life orders, judges, that is. I read about this quite a while ago. The general consensus is, when a whole life order is given out, it can be easier to appeal than a one with a minimum life, because one with life with a minimum, basically, because it's got, let's say this for example, it's got a starting point of 30 years. Now the judge has to, in their summing up, explain exactly why they've either added or taken years away. But for a whole life order, it's just whole life, so it's harder to justify on appeal why it should be a whole life, where you could say what it's got to say. For example, it's got a starting point of 30 years, and then you'd add on this amount of years. And so it's that just it's just for that, really.
Okay.
But so
okay,
yeah.
So my guess is 38 years.
Oh, he's close. So he got 34 years in total.
Oh, wow. Okay. I thought you were going to say higher. So 4 extra years because of this shotgun sawn off. And...
Well, sort of, no, because he got 7 years for the shotgun. But it was to run concurrently, so it doesn't really count.
Okay.
So that wasn't really a... The extra 4 years were for use of a weapon and the torture aspects, basically.
Oh, okay.
So
I mean, no amount of time will do, because the victim's family are left without such a gorgeous, like, happy, trusting, wonderful individual. However, 34 years, as far as it goes, is a decent sentence, isn't it, for such an evil man?
It's a decent sentence, because he's going to have to really justify why he should be let out. First, he's got to admit to it, which he hasn't ever done, explain what happened, and then justify it. So he's going to be like, he was 27 when he was convicted, so he's going to be like 61-ish when he gets out, 60, 61. So if he, minimum term, so it's going to be hard for him. But yeah, and like what you say, like that, the picture I picked for the, like, social media promos, if anyone's seen it, I made a conscious effort to find a nice picture of her with her smiling, because it really portrayed her personality. So yeah, it's you'd think maybe it should, I'd think that it maybe should be a bit longer, but yeah, I mean, it's one of these ones where I think concurrently is right for the majority of sentences, because you can't have it consecutively, because otherwise you could have minor criminals be in prison for decades.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think consecutive should be. So, like, it should be, like, 34 years minimum. And then whenever he gets, say, okay, you can get out, then he serves his 7 years and gets half of that, if that makes sense, or two-thirds.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, that there should almost be, like, a bracket system where, as well, depending on the severity of the initial crime or the main crime or the fundamental crime, then qualifies the criteria of the additional charges. So, okay, he completed a Category A criminal offence and has been found guilty of that. He should have his sentence for the Category B or C crimes to run consecutively, because he is, you know, thing. But then I guess it would get complicated for cases, you know, where somebody gets away with manslaughter instead of murder. And do you know what I mean? It's not simple as us kind of like saying that. There'd be so many gray areas, wouldn't there?
They would, you're right. Yeah, it's just one of those aspects of the law that when we're talking about it theoretically, it'd be nice, but in reality, it couldn't be done.
Do sentences in America tend to run consecutively?
Do you know what? Maybe we'll let our listeners answer that one, because I'm not too sure. I mean, for murder and that, they get like a billion years anyway, don't they? But but I don't know. Maybe our listeners could answer that one, because I'm not too certain. Shall I wrap this one up, Rachel?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, go for it. There's not a lot you can say that probably hasn't already been said about them, but yeah, go for it.
So this has been Season 4, Episode 19, called Murder for Gain. And if it's safe for you to do so, I'd like you to relax. Close your eyes and picture the scene. Now, I'd like to ask all of you, is that all life is worth these days? A few thousand pounds. Thank you all, and goodbye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.